Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Jeff Plunkett, a wonderful actor who is currently here at Florida Studio Theater as part of an ensemble cast playing in Michael McKeever's South Beach Babylon. Hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap.
Recently, it was brought to my attention that this phrase, living the life you were meant to live, may be misleading. I don't mean that fate had in mind for you or your destiny, although if that is true, then I hope you are living the life that destiny had in mind for you. But what I'm talking about is not that. What I'm talking about is that I believe we are born with abilities, with capacities, with tendencies, and that it is using them, exploring them, discovering them, making them real, that allows us to live a life that all that we are allows for. Boy, I hope that's clear. And that unfortunately, very few of us are able to use what we came in with. As a therapist, I experience over and over again people who are not able to access all that is there for them. Because somehow in their childhood, either because of something that occurred in their family of origin, or something that happened to them in school, or something that peers did to them, or their culture or their religion told them that something that was natural to them was not okay. Some way of being, some thought process it wasn't all right. And so when they demonstrated this, whatever that was, it brought a consequence which was painful, hurtful, embarrassing, traumatic even. And so as children, we're so flexible. We are able to use denial, that word that so many people think of as, an enemy. But I don't. I believe that denial is a gift from the unconscious. Our unconscious uses denial to hide things which we, for some reason, are unable to tolerate or endure. So let's say you were a very spunky kid, and you had a lot of energy, and you liked to tell jokes and laugh a lot. And you lived in a family where that way of being was seen as ugly or irreverent. And so very quickly, you were told, shown, it was demonstrated to you that that kind of behavior was really not okay. Today I was talking to a woman who told me that when she, that her father would humiliate her when she did something not as well as he thought she should. So she became someone who was afraid to try new things, afraid of what she was sure was going to come, which was the humiliation and embarrassment. So if you had a family or a culture or a religion or a best friend or a teacher who criticized you, embarrassed you, humiliated you, teased you, punished you for things that were natural to you, things that came easily and comfortably to you, then you probably learned to first hide those things and deny that they were true, and then over time forget entirely that you had those qualities. Then what I believe happens, and I write about this in my book, which is, by the way, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. So in the book, I talk about something I call our cover story. This is a version of ourselves that we believe to be true, that we demonstrate and tell other people are what we are. And while it is almost certainly a truth, it is not the truth. And mostly, we have qualities which we have hidden undercover, because they were the ones that brought the consequences, the reactions that we did not want to have. The problem with this is that quite often later in life, it is precisely those qualities that we put undercover, like this woman's inability to try something new. You can see how that can undermine a life. And of course, she came in with the desire to try new things, and the courage, and the pleasure, and delight about trying new things. It was the teasing and humiliation that made her decide that that was not a safe thing to do. But you can see how later in life, being able to do that would be a benefit, and not being able to do that would be a detriment. So many of us are lumbered with the need to hide undercover aspects of ourselves. So if this interests you, I talk about why this happens, as I have been doing in the show, and what you can do about it. I do that in some of the other shows. I do that in the book. And you can listen to the other shows, and you can get a copy of the book. You can learn about psychotherapy on the go, which is actually psychotherapy on the telephone, which is the only way I do it these days. You can get me to come and talk to your group or organization. You can ask me anything you like by clicking on the email tab. And you can listen to all of the interviews that I've done, like the one I'm doing today. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, And I do that because when you listen to people who make their living or their life with an art, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. These people, at least in the area of their work, are themselves. They are not hiding undercover in this aspect of their life. This is true because it's so hard to make a life, never mind a living, with an art in our culture, that it really has to be who you are. And I play these interviews in the hope that you will hear what that sounds like and be inspired to wonder if maybe there is something you have been hiding which you could resurrect, recover, and which can enhance your life by giving you back something which is actually already yours. The interview I'm doing today is with Jeff Plunkett. This is the second interview I've done with Jeff. Last season, I interviewed him when he was here at Florida Studio Theater, starring in The Columnist. The first half of this interview is the first half of that interview. And that interview included a very lengthy description of the show, The Columnist, and all of the things that Jeff knew about the character he was playing. The second part of this interview is Jeff talking about the show he is currently in. He is currently in South Beach, Babylon. If you were listening last week, both Beth Duda, who is the educational director of Florida Studio Theater, and Michael McKeever, who wrote South Beach, Babylon, talked about the show. And this week, we're going to have Jeff, who is part of the ensemble, talking about the show. One of the wonderful things about interviewing Jeff, and you'll hear it in the first part of this interview, is that he describes a childhood, a family, which was completely supportive of everything that he was. And so it allowed him to explore, to experiment, to be curious about a variety of different ways of being in the world, and to arrive at the one that spoke most loudly to him, that of being an actor. And when you see Jeff on stage, and I hope that you will all come down to see him in South Beach, Babylon, you know that this was the right choice, because he's quite wonderful on stage. So now I'm just going to turn the stage over to Jeff, and you can hear him tell his story and also talk about the play he's currently in, South Beach, Babylon. Okay, so I'm here with Jeff Plunkett in a rehearsal room at FST. Okay, so I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Yes.
And as an actor, I'm making the psychic leap that's what you do, is that correct?
I do, yes.
Okay, good. And I only ask one question.
Please.
How did it happen? How did it start? Not what was your first job, but what was the first moment in your life that it occurred to you that acting, stories, entertaining, maybe making people pay attention or laugh, any that became a part of your consciousness?
I became very young. I remember in second grade we were reading a story, and then there was a textbook had a play in it, and we just started reading that aloud, and there was just a certain joy I felt in trying to make these words on the page sound spontaneous. Next time.
Really? So second grade, seven?
Seven, I guess.
Eight? Yeah. Something like that? Seven. This is an interesting thing to say. That you spontaneously decided to make the words more interesting, more than just read them. Was that a direction from the teacher?
I think I kind of I always love for language. My parents kind of instilled that in me.
How did they do that?
Just encouraging reading. I lived in a small town growing up and went to the library all the time, and there was a small grammar school, some small student-teacher ratio.
Uh-huh.
I thought I had good guidance and attention. And that love of literature then...
Stories.
Stories kind of developed into a storytelling love as well. And, you know, as you know, there's a very distinct difference between a novel and a play. A play is rather like the score of a symphony. You can certainly read the notes, but it's not only until performance takes place that the life...
It's just laying there.
Just laying there, exactly.
Yeah. So at seven, you have a clear memory of seeing these words and thinking, well, I can do something with this.
Absolutely. I made the distinction very young that there was a difference between literature and playwriting.
That there was a difference between just reading the thing and then somehow becoming it or acting it, or
absolutely.
Is that what you mean?
Absolutely.
Right, okay. So here you are at seven in the second grade, and I'm assuming everybody is reading off this thing. Was it read aloud?
It's read aloud.
Mm-hmm. And
it's very informal.
Yeah,
really,
no.
It wasn't a seminal moment in my life. It just...
Oh, I think you're wrong, actually.
In retrospect, it was. But happening, it certainly made, had no great impact on me whatsoever, except that I just remember a distinct enjoyment of it.
Yeah, see, I think that is what makes it seminal, actually. I mean, you can ask, I don't know, everybody on the street what they remember about when they were seven, and most of them will not have any memories from the time they were seven.
It's really traumatic. I broke my arm.
Did you? Oh, you mean what happened?
That's my first memory, though.
Is your broken arm?
What their first memory is. Usually something traumatic.
Traumatic, of course. Okay, so at that moment when you're reading, did anyone comment on it? Or were you aware that you were doing something different than other people were doing?
My teacher just said, you seem to have a taking towards this. So she was very encouraging.
Yeah, right. This was really a big deal, actually. I think this was very important.
You
know, not only that you found it inside of yourself, but immediately you got re-encouragement.
Absolutely.
For it. That's great. Okay, good. So
here's to our teachers,
And here's to our good teachers, right?
Teachers, yeah.
Absolutely. So, and the other thing I want to say about that is, what she did was really nice. She complimented you on it. No, that's not even right. She commented on the fact that it seemed to have meaning for you.
Exactly.
And she didn't put anybody else down by that.
Exactly.
Right. And it was perfect. Mm-hmm. Good for you, whoever you are.
Mrs. West.
So, okay, so what is the next thing that happens that leads you in this path?
So I also enjoyed singing quite a bit. And my mother will deny this to this day. She really doesn't anymore. But when I was little with her, she would sing around the house. And she had a rich, alto, dense, loud voice. Mm-hmm. And I recall it was, I think the musical Hair in like the top 10 on radio shows, and she loved those songs. I remember she was pregnant with my little brother Chris, and we would...
And how old were you?
So I was 5 or 6, and so she'd be singing around the house, and I enjoyed that. And so I quickly enjoyed singing. So that was a lot about actors. Their kind of career begins with singing. And I have a blessing and a curse. I had chronic ear infections growing up, which I still am grappling with to this day. And because I was singing so much, my parents took me to a pediatrician who happened to know a woman who not only gave voice lessons, but ran this rather esteemed opera company on the New Jersey shore. And so at a young age, I think I was 13, I started studying with her.
Wow.
So we thought that perhaps learning how to sing correctly might
help your ears.
Strain my voice, my ears. So it was really...
Wow. Talk about...
A dark moment came in. Bright light, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I was singing small roles with her opera company then, at a young age, studying with her through high school then.
Okay, so you're already on stage.
Already on stage.
Yeah, you're already performing. You're already thinking of yourself
right as
a performer.
I was. But she was very pragmatic, and she's... insisted, actually, that I study something else when she sent me off to college. This is my voice teacher. And so I did.
What did you study?
I studied psychology and biology. And I was on a pre-med track in undergraduate school.
Wow.
And I went to a small undergraduate school, which afforded me the opportunity to almost pick and choose the roles I wanted to play.
Because there
was a small... It wasn't even... When I was there, now it's... booming and growing theater department, but there wasn't even a theater department. It was just this wing of the English department that put on 4 productions a year. And I was graced. They were wonderful years. We had woman who's still there, whose sets I've yet to work on, more beautiful sets, and this director who was legendary, who worked with Eric Bentley, who had done Bertolt Brecht's adaptation. So I just had this incredible cadre of talented support while I was pursuing something completely different. So my focus was split in college, and that was fine. I often tell young students that I think a good, broad-based liberal arts education is really important to any artist, just because you have so much more to draw on. You're exposed to science, and literature, and philosophy, and religion. And
yeah.
Like that, so.
Yeah. I think that's right. So you completed college. You got a degree in either psychology or biology, right? And did you have a minor in drama?
No,
you never even did that.
Like that was not even possible. I perhaps would have nowadays, but that was not even.
Okay, so you graduate. You've got a BA or something.
Yes, and I at that point I knew I probably didn't want to go to med school, and it was funny because I had even taken summer physics classes and things just to catch up.
You're a good boy.
Good boy. And, but in my senior year, I had auditioned for a lot of really premier graduate programs in acting. And right down the road from, I went to Bucknell University for undergraduate, and right down the road was Penn State University, which had an enormous theater program. And they had offered me a graduate fellowship, and it was the day after graduation that I called them and said, is that offer still on the table? And they said yes. So.
And you said yes.
I said yes. Mm-hmm. These were heady days of graduate school, too.
Ooh.
There was seemed to be a lot of money, and there were stipends, and...
Yeah, there was money around.
There was money around.
Yeah, right.
So
you, were, you were lucky. Right,
yeah. Right. So it was, I lived in the nicest apartment I've ever lived in. I had a car, and... those were heady days in graduate school. And so that was 3 years of conservatory training.
Well, did your family notice that you weren't going to be a doctor,
yeah,
you were going to be an actor?
Completely supportive. I'm very fortunate that way. Not all families are. And I think every parent knows how, you know, fraught with difficulty this career path is. And if they don't, they're kidding themselves. Because it is. I mean, you know, 99% of actors aren't working at any given time in the union.
Right.
Not even the ones that aren't union. So, but I appreciate it. They, you know, when in the balance of life, you know, happiness over financial success, they seem to prefer happiness.
For you.
For me, which I'm very fortunate, and I'm continuing to be grateful to them for that. And let me just mention, they are across the state right now, and they winter in Port St. Lucie. And I think my parents have missed maybe two shows I've been in my entire career. So
wow.
I imagine they'll be tracking their way over.
I'm sure that's right. That's
lucky.
Yeah, you are definitely lucky. There's no question about it. You've had support in every place that you were.
Isn't that something?
Yes, it is something.
It is something.
I mean, you didn't get, what are you thinking, who do you think you are, what
absolutely.
Are you crazy, any of that, which is what most people who are going to try and make a living, certainly as an actor, my God,
right.
You know, get. So so you had a pretty easy ride, and then, you know, Penn State says, open arms, here, come and let us give you money and take care of you and
yeah.
study here, right? Okay. So you have these 3 years of this extraordinary conservatory experience.
Yeah, morning to night.
Morning to night.
Yeah.
Loved every minute.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, right. You're in heaven. And then you graduate.
And I graduate. That's funny you put it that way. That was difficult to graduate. It was difficult to leave that incubus.
That doesn't sound strange to me.
Perhaps,
yeah.
Right. It was...
I mean, really, it's literally like leaving the womb.
It is leaving the womb and leaving the womb without parents.
No, that's exactly right.
Right.
That's exactly right. Nothing. You're sort of dumped out of the womb.
Right. And one thing about... picking a graduate program that's not so affiliated with a New York base or
right, or Chicago
base,
or Chicago, any of those places.
You really are a little left more to your own devices. That changed. I think my program that I went to has realized that, and other programs realize that they need to transition their actors a little better into the marketplace.
Yeah, that it's not just about training them, but it's about helping them get work.
They were not unclear about that. We did have classes in the business of being an actor.
That's not the same thing.
Not the same thing as actually leading one into the next step.
Right, right.
So I did. I moved.
Or having some kind of connection that where that you're feeding, that
right.
somebody's expecting you. Right, right,
right.
Okay, so you leave the hallowed halls,
yeah.
and you're standing there with your degree, right? Exactly.
Yeah.
And you're in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Right? So?
So I lived close to New York. I was born up there, and then I was familiar with New York. So I made the move. I made two moves to New York. The first did not go that well. It was hard, and I was living far away from my job waiting tables and was learning the subway system.
Where were you living?
I was living in Long Island City, which was a ghost town at that time.
Yeah.
Now everyone's living in Long Island City. But
or Brooklyn.
Brooklyn. But back then, not many people did. And lonely train rides. Another great thing about this business is the people that I went to school with are the people that continued to help me in my career. And that's what happened. I ended up kind of booking things through people I knew. And that has been the story of my life for the next two decades.
This is, of course, not an unusual story.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, for anything.
Yes,
I tell
for
every
anything.
Student who's right. in their classmates, and one reason not to bully is
the
person
never
sitting next to you,
yes.
be a CEO someday, absolutely.
Right.
Help you up the chain.
Right, or not.
Or not, right.
Right. Okay, so the first go-around in New York, did you get work?
I got work, yeah. Right out the bat, I was graced. And then that has its pluses and minuses. You get a false sense of how the business works. So, yeah, I was working quite a bit in my youth, my early days. And then a dry spell came. It got really dark. And I tried to find some... I wasn't looking for other career paths. I just need to pay the rent, as everyone actor does. And I was managing restaurants for quite a while. I started as a waiter, and I was managing. And by the time I was managing a rather famous restaurant called Orso, I was married to that job, and I realized I had completely lost track of my goals there. The money was extraordinary,
but the happiness was not.
Yeah, the happiness was not. It was time-consuming.
You'd switched the emphasis from the happiness to the finance.
I find it absolutely extraordinary. And here's my hat off to waiters. And every actor probably has to wait tables. And every waiter here in town. People go into restaurants and they lose their minds. They feel like they're in an emergency room. And they come screaming up to you and say, my chicken's cold. Yeah, I didn't lose your spleen. Well, I'm happy to go back and warm this. There's just this incredible sense of urgency in restaurants that is
and sense of entitlement.
Yes.
Right.
So I knew I didn't want to do that anymore, and I parlayed that into I was working in hotels, and I'm now a New York tour guide. I have my own company giving tours of New York City, which is great because I get to call upon all the things I learned in school in terms of keeping 50 people entertained for anywhere from 8 hours to 5 days, and trying to infuse excitement about, it's not too hard, about New York City, but bring people around and engaging them and speaking extemporaneously.
Spontaneous, a little improv here.
A little improv, trying to throw a few jokes in there, keep the act fresh. So I enjoy it.
I could be wrong about this, but you get to choose your hours.
That's
right?
Absolutely right.
Right, you want to work, you don't want to work.
Extraordinary flexible.
Right.
Flexible. So
right.
I can, what I've done is I've put that business on hold for...
Okay, so tell me about South Beach Babylon.
It's a wonderful play by a playwright who Florida can claim as their own, Michael McKeever. And he came to our first read-through, and he added a lovely kind of introspective scene for Matthew, who plays Jonas. We just get a little more about his journey.
Jeffrey, I need you to move up a little
closer,
because
please.
You talk. It's funny because on stage you don't do this. On stage, you're very
much easier to speak when you're playing someone else.
Well, maybe you could pretend to be someone else.
A louder person.
A louder person. That's very funny. Actually, I'd like to talk a little bit about that, if you don't mind, but let's talk about the show first.
Yeah, so Mike, and then Michael came back for our tech week. And just adjusted a few more things, tweaked, very like minor tweaks.
Tell me about the introspective scene.
Yeah, there's a scene that Michael felt and Kate felt that the Jonas character just we as the audience needed to have a little more information about his process and why he feels stuck, and so there's a wonderful kind of short scene that Michael wrote that explains his process as an artist a little more fully.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I'll bet Michael loved that.
Yes, it is great to... there's nothing set in stone about his script. I'm sure if Shakespeare were alive today, he'd be tweaking stuff as well. So.
No, I'm sure that's right. But as Michael said in his interview, a lot of writers make the mistake of thinking, you know, I wrote that line. I don't care if it doesn't work.
Right.
You know,
right.
I wrote it and it's mine and we leave it, and he doesn't have any of that.
Right.
Yeah. And so he's able to do what he did for you guys, which is make the play more accessible to the audience that's actually going to see it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Okay, so that's about Michael. What about the show itself? My experience of you is that you're pretty thoughtful about the work you do, the characters you play. Did you spend much time with this guy, or did you know him so well you could wing it?
No, two things. He's a photographer, so in the month before I came down, I spent some time with photographers.
Did you?
Just to see how they shoot, number one, and...
Well, you know, I thought about that when you were doing it. I thought, boy, he looks like he knows what he's doing.
I didn't, so... Nor do I, frankly.
Well, never mind. You're such a good actor.
And the other thing was he has a scene where he's learning to play golf, and my father lives on a golf course. My parents have a home on the other coast of Florida where they winter, and he golfs every day, and he was always asking me to play. I have three brothers who took up the slack. It never intrigued me in the least. It's anxiety-producing, frankly. So I spend a weekend with my dad, and just show me how to follow through and swing a little bit and tee off. So that was fun.
I bet he loved that.
So it was great. Yes. So I don't think this is all theatrical miming that's going on stage with a fun sound effect that our amazing sound intern put together. Frankly, the interns here are just remarkable. So that was. Those are two aspects of the character that I had no knowledge about and got to learn about, which was quite fun.
Yeah. How did you feel about this character?
That's a great question, because I felt I felt far away from him, and I felt the play is written in these tiny pastiches, really. So
you want to talk about a little bit about that?
The structure of the play is really these quick, tiny kind of knee plays, as I call them, or little mini plays that kind of all blend together and bleed into one another, which is a lovely theatrical device. And so it was incumbent, I think, upon all of us to build in our own heads who these people were. And the cast do a lovely... This is a remarkable cast, and I just want to make sure I make that point. It's a wonderful ensemble, and everyone has their moments, I think, in the play.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone came in with a lot of great ideas about who these people were. And it's not to say that Michael didn't put that in the play, but because of the nature of the play, he invites us to bring our own personalities to each character. I think that's best said. So everyone came, did their research and came in with ideas about who their people were and what this event was, and... we just sat at the table for 3 days, really just knocking those ideas around. That's really, I was thinking about that the other day, how we have to honor the process of putting any piece of art up, which is really what this play is about. It's a play by an artist about art. which is why I think it's resonant. Every single moment of the play has been pulled apart and put back together again, and every play does that. And even when I'm in plays in tiny theaters in New York, that the process never is shelved. So I really try to honor everything I see with an open mind, knowing that even if some things weren't working, perhaps, I know that those people have spent hours and days on every single moment. There's not one stone left unturned when a play hits the stage, typically. That's been my experience.
It's such an interesting thing to say. I mean, people, you know, it's called playing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that people discount, well, that's not the right word, but they don't think it's serious. They don't think it's hard. They don't, people who are not actors really don't have a clue how difficult it is, how much work it takes, how much work people do. That's what you're talking about, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So we want to take this opportunity to tell you that it's a serious business. People aren't playing. they're playing. That's not actually true. They are. It's fun, too.
It is fun. It's fun when you can throw aside all of that work and then just actually play the moments because you've really explored them so fully. I spend a kind of a month looking at certain artists on YouTube, and my artist of the month is the violinist Gil Shayam, and I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing his name right because I've only seen it written. He plays, he's such a virtuoso, and he plays so beautifully and effortlessly, and you just know that every single note he's pondered over. And
it's interesting because that was the comparison I was going to make. I was going to make it to a musician,
yeah.
Not necessarily a violinist, but you work for years and years and years and years and years to develop the skill, and then you forget it, right? And you let it because you've got it inside yourself,
right?
Right, and that is something that people don't. I really don't think people understand that actors do that.
Yeah.
So Ned, so you said, and I didn't forget. You said that you felt distanced from this character.
I just knew I had to kind of pull him in towards me, perhaps.
Well, what was it about him that was not you?
I didn't know what it was like to be a photographer or someone who's, he's on the verge of great success, like millions, so someone who's on the cusp of that. Someday.
But and you'll be prepared, because you worked on this character, right? You'll know how it feels. You'll know what to do. Right?
I'll know to call a financial advisor.
Well, but Michael said he thought that all the characters are approaching their work differently. They have different relationship to the work and why they're doing it, and one of them has sold his soul. And I assumed when I watched it that he thought that was your character, and I didn't feel that way. Did you?
No.
I mean, maybe it's because you played it like this was a good thing you were doing, and you were proud of it, and there wasn't any bitterness in it, or... Do you understand what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah. I can see that was Michael's thought of the character. And I could see perhaps playing it that way. And he does fight with his best friend about whether he sold his soul or not. But I think in the end, as Michael's written it, frankly, he's the one who seems to be doing it the most efficiently or the most...
Well, he seems to be the most satisfied. He seems to be the person who's in the most at peace with himself.
Yeah, yes. I feel that was my... when I read it, I thought he has a center. He has a goal, and he realizes he knows the game, and he doesn't fall prey to the game. Some characters fall prey to the game.
Yeah, he isn't tricked into thinking anything other than this is he's a good photographer. He has an opportunity to make a lot of money doing what he loves.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to get stuck in the politics of it. He can just do. Right.
He actually manipulates the politics of it. He's clever. I think he's clever.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. So I agree with your choice to play it.
I think he's Michael, frankly. You know, Michael's pretty egoless, and I think the character Tony is pretty egoless as well. And that play full of, in a fun way, of ego, of people who's, you know, which is always the difficult thing about the artist, to separate yourself from what you're doing. And particularly for actors who are, bring a lot of themselves to each character. Perhaps less so for painters and for performance artists, but there's a difference between, I think, who you are and not only, certainly the business of art, and it is a business.
Oh, yeah.
Make no mistake. And also, I'm thinking of other characters who would disagree with that. The Simon character would probably disagree that your soul has to be very much wrapped up in, or not, your philosophy, your life philosophy, which is really the core of who you are, has to be wrapped up in your art. And I don't dispute that as much as to say that I think they're, you know, art isn't therapy, you know, and acting isn't therapy. So there is a line between your process, who you are as a person, and then
what you do. My temptation would have been to say, if your sense of yourself, which I think is what you meant when you were talking about ego, gets too enmeshed with the work, you're too dependent on the work either being successful or, in Simon's case, living up to your idea of what it needs to be. Simon, character in the play, by the way. Then you're in danger because you can't control how other people are going to see it. And it could be wonderful, but for whatever reason, other people couldn't see it. And then if you're, as I'm repeating myself, self-esteem is too tied up with that, then you're, I don't know, peace, serenity, sanity is at risk.
Absolutely.
You know?
And I think in art, there's always a danger of that.
Yeah, I agree. I was going to say, so while maybe ideally there is some kind of distance that you can have with that, it's tricky.
Mm-hmm.
It's tricky.
It's a great life lesson, because you never do.
No.
You really don't.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think
it's just saying that what other people think of me is none of my business.
Yes, I know. Can you do that?
You don't have to answer. That's a great question. Yeah, I think everyone struggles with that. I think everyone in the world struggles with that.
I agree.
Yeah.
And to some extent, artists have to struggle with that more, because so much of what they do depends, at least for their finances, if nothing else, on what other people think.
Absolutely. Right.
Right, right.
I think that's where I think you have to draw the line as a person versus your craft.
So very few people like Simon have someone like your character to make sure they're okay.
Yeah, I think that's a lovely part of the play.
It's a lovely part of the play.
I'm glad you saw that, because I wasn't sure if that was going to.
Oh, yeah.
But Kate said it in one of our rehearsals, that that's the one friendship relationship that goes throughout the entire piece, and we tend to follow those relationships in our heads.
Well, it isn't only that it's a friendship. It is that they care for each other, right?
Yeah.
They care for each other even when their philosophies are so different.
Absolutely.
Right, right. And that's another thing that makes your character so likable. He's at peace with himself, and so he can afford to be generous.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know if I've even thought of it that way. I did think of how he goes to bat for other people rather than himself.
He does it for Jonas.
He mentors him.
He does.
Yeah.
He does. And he's just kind. He's just kind. He's not, I mean, so many of the other characters are not, because they're so involved in what they need for themselves.
Right.
You know, that they can't really. That's actually, I mean, this is somewhat far afield, but in terms of what human beings are capable of, you know, it's like that thing with the, on the plane, you know, you put the oxygen on yourself
first
before you put it on someone else, because you have to have it before you can give it.
Right.
Right? So I want to say that your character is not the most dramatic on the stage, but I found him to be maybe the most authentic, you know? And I always love to watch you on stage.
That's a lovely compliment. Just a plug for old age, if you will. It finally happened. I'm the oldest person in this cast.
Are you really?
Never happened before. Having said that, I think of the like artists I look up to who like paved the way, the older artists I've worked with, who I so admired, and I just watched them and learned. And I think that's kind of one of the points here, is that there's a, you know, there's a wisdom and a peace that comes with having gone through the fire of youth.
Yes.
And that, you know, this character is old enough to know that regardless of what happens, he'll survive, and that he can be generous to younger artists. Mm-hmm. And to his friend, who's struggling with himself, and he's his own worst enemy, and struggling financially. And
so he can honor his friends.
Yeah. I don't want to give it a major plot point of the end away, but my character does something instead of, when he has an opportunity to further his own career, he does something for his friend.
Right.
And I wondered why that happened, and as I read it, and a friend of mine actually helped me realize this at the audition, when I was auditioning for it, realized that the art promoter, who things swirl around, played beautifully by
Priscilla. She's amazing. God, she's amazing.
She's quite wonderful. She does a lot of manipulating, which is all fine, and my character realizes that, and he actually says at one point that artists need people like her. She is the business part of this model is as valid as the artistic part, and her role is very influential, and we have to...
She gets things done.
What she does do, though, I think that my character thinks is unforgivable, is she censors an artist. And I think the act of censorship is unforgivable. I think that's a great point in the play.
And so she gets her comeuppance.
She does get her comeuppance for that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm not sure if that... I hope that reads, because I think that's the reason...
It's interesting.
That she gets her due, because she, as much as she can, as much as she is a player, and as much as she does things that are ethically questionable, perhaps, she really crosses the line at censorship. And I think Michael makes a beautiful point there.
I agree.
Yeah. It's subtle. It's a very subtle play. And some of the characters are huge and enormous and beautifully played, and some are very subtle. I think that's why, my character's name is Tony, and I think that's why he sees himself in the younger Jonas, because he's a subtle, sensitive young man, and I think he sees himself in that.
Well, and also Tony went through a whole bunch of growing up before he became what he is now, didn't he?
Right. Apparently he was a Lothario and
made reference to models.
But he's married and
yeah,
not sleeping with models anymore
and
accepting
happy.
His old age
and happy.
Yeah.
That was the thing I thought. That in profoundly, your character is the only really happy guy on the stage.
Oh, that's, yeah, I guess so.
Everybody else wants something they haven't got.
Yeah.
But Tony doesn't.
Yeah.
That was how I read it.
Mm-hmm.
That it is possible to be an artist, to have a life, to be committed to your work, but not owned by it,
mm-hmm.
to be happy.
I think Michael's at that point in his career.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think there's a lot of Michael in that character. I love the play for the fact he doesn't judge anyone.
He's
written these 8 roles, and I want to plug our 2 multi-roled, talented younger artists who are playing the performance artists, waiters, and lifeguards,
right.
and secretaries.
Right.
We have 2 wonderful actors, Cindy and Hector, who are playing
every day.
10 roles and constantly changing costumes. But Graziani, who plays Chili, is wonderful.
Oh, he's amazing.
Amazing. And Roger brings so much passion to Simon. And Larissa could easily play the model as vapid, and she doesn't. She plays her kind of...
No, she has a kind of wisdom.
She really does.
Yes, she does.
And she's... there's a purity about her and a...
Innocence.
Yeah, it's lovely.
It
naivete is lovely.
Is lovely,
but she, as you said, she's wise as well. And
that line, that wonderful line, you have a wonderful heart, I'm gonna hate it when I break it.
Which is, you know,
it's great.
It's very dense. And then she also is wise enough to say that, you know, she realizes the relationship she's in, she can never compete.
Right.
Which she has a moment of self-revelation, which Larissa plays beautifully, when they she realizes she could never compete with someone else's narcissism or image.
It's a great line,
yeah,
too.
It's a great line. And I think we've all been in those kinds of relationships
when
we're attracted by narcissism.
Well, they're very attractive, aren't they?
There's brilliance to it, absolutely.
Right, right. Yes, those of us who are attracted to brilliance.
Yeah.
Not everybody is.
Everyone is, yes. I want to make sure I haven't left anyone out because... Oh, well, Matthew, who's just so charming in real life and on stage. He just brings so much of himself to that role. And lovable and just delightful.
The play is wonderful. The play is wonderful, and I am happy to be having yet another opportunity to plug the play, which I did one in Michael's interview, because come down and see it. It's really wonderful. The other question that I ask is, having given a life to the art of acting, is there anything you would want to say about it?
It's such a joy. I mean, you don't get to do it as much as you would want sometimes, usually, sometimes not. But whenever you have the opportunity, I've learned about music, and I've learned about history, and I've learned about art, and I've learned about sports, and I've learned about... how to play the violin, and I've learned about every play has these unique, as we mentioned, windows and specific challenges, dialects. It's so easy to call, you know, people say, oh, it's a holy experience, and it is the church. And I put perspective on it, you know, this is a play, and we're playing, but it is important because we play together, you know? So the community that comes to support this is as more important than anything we're doing up there, because we're having this shared experience. The rehearsals are a joy because you're meeting people that become your lifelong friends, and then you come back together sometimes, which is even more remarkable. And you learn about yourself, a place like this exists where they're committed to bring people back. You have these second homes all across the country, you know? So lovely here, good heavens. You know? And every time I get back here, I think, oh, this is looking for a place maybe, or keeping your eye out on the for sale signs. Because I get that asked a lot as a tour guide in New York. People often ask, do you ever see yourself living any other place? And my answer is absolutely, you know. I'm lucky enough to leave New York
in the
often
storm.
Enough right, that I don't, it doesn't drive me insane, because I think it can, you know, it's a fast-paced city to constantly be in, but that's another great thing about a career. It just brings you to great places in the world where you meet new people and just create new homes for yourself.
That's a good place to stop.
Okay.
And we would be happy to have you, Jeff.
I appreciate that. We'll keep looking together.
Thank you, Jeff.
It was so nice. Thank you.
So you hear in Jeff what I talked about at the beginning, that he is a person who was encouraged from the very beginning to accept, enjoy, and honor who he is. And so at every turn, he was able to ask himself, is this what I want? Do I like this? Does this fit me? You can even hear it in the end when he's talking about where he might like to live. He's always able to ask the question, is this me? And in the end, that is what I believe makes the difference between a satisfying and an unsatisfying life.
So many of the people that I interview, although they arrived finally at the thing that was right for them, and in the case of everyone I interview, that thing is an art. But they may have explored, toyed with, actually become something else on the way. As Jeff explored his interest in biology and psychology and medicine, many of the artists that I interview didn't leap into the art, although they always knew they had an interest, they always knew they were drawn to it, but they let themselves look at everything because they weren't afraid that they might make a bad choice, that they might choose wrong. They had the sense that it was okay for them to be who they were. And that quite often takes choosing something that's wrong before you find the thing that's right, or before you give yourself to the thing that's right. And actually, having said this, we talk a lot these days about serial careers, that one career may not be enough. The career that looked good to you at the beginning may have been good to you, and you may run out of it and choose another. But underneath all of this is the idea that you can be true to yourself, that you can be yourself, that you can find yourself and be that person. Because if you can do that, whatever you do, whether it has to do with a career, as it is when I talk to, you know, the artists, or when it just has to do with a quality, a way of being in the world, the permission to say, I really don't want to go to that party, I think I'll stay home tonight, you know, the permission to say, well, okay, you can stay home tonight, I think I'll go to the party, the permission to be who you are so you can live the life that fits you. Well, okay, I'm probably running over, so let me say, I sure hope that you heard something in this show that you can use. Of course, something that inspired you, something that interested you, something that you didn't know that you heard for the first time, something that's going to make you come down and see South Beach Babylon, something that's going to bring you back next week. Because as always, I will be here, same time, same station, next week, and I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. That I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good